Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, a wealth tax on millionaire households rather than hike income tax for the masses to deal with the corona crisis. A good idea, or could it massively backfire? Beware mortgage holidays, millions have taken them, but are they risking even bigger problems in the future? Meanwhile, the stamp duty holiday has proven a false economy, as Halifax say house prices have stripped even the biggest savings. Also today, could a pension black hole sink your investments? And we revisit the crisis at the ports. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, the economic emergency has only just begun, according to the Chancellor. National debt has spiralled as the government has spent more than £280 billion tackling the virus so far and its financial fallout. Now, the big white elephant in the room is, how the heck are we going to pay for all this? Well, one suggestion is a one-off wealth tax on the richest households rather than hiking taxes for the masses. Now, that's the finding of a new in-depth report from the Wealth Tax Commission. Simon, tell us more.
Right. So we have the Wealth Tax Commission. I bet you can't guess what they're in favour of. A wealth tax. Yes. Well done, everybody. 5 points to you, minus 1% of 5 points, because that's your wealth tax for getting the answer right. The Wealth Tax Commission would like a wealth tax. It says that we need to pay the bill for the coronavirus crisis. I mean, this does presume that we are actually going to pay the bill for the coronavirus crisis and balance the books. I must say that we should make that point before we start out, because at the moment, what's actually paying the bill is the Bank of England printing money. And countries around the world have been indulging in this, either individually or as a collective block, such as the ECB. So I possibly envisage a scenario where we don't ever end up paying that bill. But if we do end up paying that bill, it's going to be expensive. Increasing income tax or VAT, two of the main taxes, and they would have to go up by quite a lot in order to pay the bill. So what could you do instead? Well, you could make the wealthy pay their way, because instead of deciding that everybody's going to have to pay, why not just tax those who have the most money in society? Seems fair enough. And one idea put forward is a tax on wealth. There are a sizable number of people who have built up a sizable number of wealth in this country. We do have a wealth gap. We do have inequality in wealth. We have many people who have quite a lot and are comfortable. And we have quite a few people who have not so much and are not comfortable. And we also had a report earlier this week that said we have an alarming number of people, this was in a report from the Rowntree Foundation, Joseph Rowntree Foundation, living in destitution. And it should be noted that whilst we sit and discuss things like stamp duty holidays, accidental savers off the back of lockdown, capital gains tax raids, and wealth tax, it said that there's basically a couple of million people living in destitution in this country. And that's something that we should all be concerned about, however much money we have. But we're not talking about getting those people out of destitution. We're talking about paying the bill for the coronavirus crisis. So the idea is that we'd have a wealth tax. And the suggestion put forward would be a tax on millionaires, basically. Millionaire couples, but it's just millionaires, really. You don't have to be in a couple. If you're just a solo millionaire, you'd get taxed too. Tax those households an extra 1% above a £1 million threshold could raise £260 billion over 5 years, according to the Wealth Tax Commission. This would be on your total wealth. Wealth tends to be defined as everything you have minus the debt. So, for example, your home minus the mortgage. That's the bit that you own. That's the wealth that you have. Your pension pot is included in this. Your investments are included in this. Your savings, etc., etc. It's always quite controversial. Firstly, the pension pot element. We have people who have two different types of pension, for a start. We have people who have a defined contribution pension where they have to build up investments themselves. And we have people who have a defined benefit pension where they have built up the right for the company or the organization that they work for to pay them a set sum in retirement, usually a percentage of their final salary. Most people working in the private sector don't get that anymore. Most people working in the public sector do get it. They have to pay more for it than people did in the past, but they'll still get it, and it's a very good benefit. If you're in a defined contribution pension, you need to build up an awful lot more money in order to get the same retirement income as you would from just raking in that each year extra by working for a company for an extra year. So you've already got a controversial element there with the pensions. Then you've got property. There's people sitting on enormous amounts of property wealth in this country. I mean, I'm sitting here in leafy Hertfordshire. I am surrounded by people sitting on enormous amounts of property wealth. Okay. There's people around here bought houses for less than £100,000. You know, they're now worth £500,000 to £1 million. And we're talking ordinary houses, nothing flash, nothing fancy, not a footballer's mansion. Are those people rich? Well, according to the Wealth Tax Commission, they are rich. If you ask those people if they're rich, they'd probably say they're not. I mean, they're rich on paper, but you can't spend your house. You have to live in your house. I mean, you could downsize, but then you're being forced out of your house. You have the scenario where your own children can't afford to buy a home in the town they grew up in. House price inflation really benefits the banks, maybe benefits the government. I'd argue it doesn't really benefit real people. The way most people cash in on their house is by dying, and that's generally not considered a win. The Wealth Tax Commission, on the other hand, says, you know, you're wealthy, you should pay your way. And maybe they should, but maybe those people have large amounts of savings. But, you know, 1% of their total wealth above £1 million, I mean, say they end up with £2 million, for example, you know, and 1% above that, they're paying £10,000 a year for 5 years. £50,000, it's a lot of money to pay out. And you end up with the scenario where you're going to get lots of stories about the, you know, the asset rich but cash poor widow living in the house in London that she bought and has lived in for the last 50 years. And it was bought for, you know, £15,000. Obviously, it's now mortgage free. It's now worth £1.5 million, but I'm not rich. And then you'll have all the stories of the people who are truly rich and somehow managed to avoid it. I think it's an absolute minefield, if you ask me.
Mm. Lee, it does seem to be law of unintended consequences, or I don't think anybody wants the scenario that you just mentioned there, Simon. So I'll say it's the law of unintended consequences. Can we ever get a wealth tax that would work, that doesn't clobber? Perhaps, because it seems to me this is going to be, especially with pensions and larger houses, elderly people.
It's really hard, Georgie, I think, to bring in something like this because, you know, who is someone that's wealthy? As Simon says there, it might be someone that's, you know, house rich on paper. They have a home that's worth quite a lot of money, but it's their home. It's not, they're not looking to flip it for profit. It might be somewhere that they've lived for a long time. They just happen to buy at the right time. It's not their fault that property prices might have started creeping up. And I hate this whole process of penalising people for, you know, being a bit successful. You know, I've had this conversation on the podcast before. I don't understand this obsession with it when we should be looking at perhaps taxing, you know, for example, I think what the public wants is to see big companies, that international companies that perhaps aren't paying their way in this country and paying the right levels of tax. You know, they're doing using systems to avoid, you know, paying proper levels of tax, for one example. This Wealth Tax Commission, just as a note here, was only set up earlier in the year. It's three people that have written this paper who are academics, are economic experts, and it's funded by the London School of Economics, Warwick University, and a few other sort of companies. So it's not like it's some official government paper, just so we're being completely clear here. It's more of a look at how we could try and borrow our way out of a couple of hundred billion pounds worth of borrowing that we've taken out for coronavirus. So I think these kind of things are always good. They always open up discussion and they help have a look at things from every kind of aspect and angle. And actually, when we look at other tax rises, any kind of tax rise, let's face it, would be deeply unpopular, whether it's national insurance, whether it's VAT, you know, whatever it is, it just won't be swallowed very well by people that are affected by it. And the same would be true of a wealth tax. It's just a very, for me, it's just, as Simon said, I think Simon really hit the nail on the head there when he said, it's a minefield. It's a minefield on a minefield. I really don't know how you would implement it. And then, of course, we've got things like inheritance tax, for example. You know, Simon was talking about there about when people die. I mean, the receipts that a Treasury receipts for inheritance tax over the next few years is set to grow substantially, for just one example there. And a lot of people will argue that they're taxed incredibly highly if they're earning over a certain amount of money over the course of their career, depending on what job it is that they do. So it just feels like it's tax on tax on tax all the time. But then Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, has a headache as to how we start tackling this bill. And I tell you what, the budget next March, let's enjoy a little bit of Christmas maybe, Georgie, and then we can start thinking about what's going to be in this budget.
Don't Lee. We won't get too much into things like all the evidence that shows that you reach a kind of, is it a breaking point, that the more you tax the wealthy, the less you actually get in tax receipts, Simon. I want to think more, before I put this to bed, politically speaking. You know, yes, Lee pointed out there that this is just a paper by the Wealth Tax Commission. It's not, it's a recommendation, I suppose, as all papers are, but it's not policy. Is it likely to be? Because this goes, doesn't it, to the heart of basically Conservative supporters, people who are older and people who are wealthy. This is going to be deeply politically unpopular.
It does, yes. I mean, it has the benefit of helping with the whole red wall achievements, in that if you're wealthy up north, you're probably going to be far less likely to end up paying the wealth tax than if you're wealthy down south, because basically you can live in a mansion for the price of a flat down in London, or a family home. But beyond those scenarios where it creates those issues, politically it is very difficult. I think politically, it was probably one of the things that was a problem for Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell. You know, they never outlined the fact that they were going to bring in a wealth tax. Everybody feared that they were going to bring in a wealth tax, or some people celebrated the fact they were going to bring in a wealth tax. But those were the people who were going to vote for them anyway. And I think that the idea that there will be some form of attack on wealth, even if it's wealth that you don't have, is sort of unpalatable to a lot of people. If we go back to inheritance tax is Britain's most hated tax. People have been asked time and time again, which of these taxes do you dislike the most? You know, which is the one you hate? Inheritance tax always comes top, but hardly anybody actually pays inheritance taxes. It's a very small number of people who pay it. I mean, when they do pay it, it can cost them an awful lot of money that somebody has built, you know, wealth that someone has built up over their lifetime, taxed earnings and things like that. Arguably, the gains you've made from a property are untaxed earnings. You haven't paid tax on that. You paid the mortgage over the years. And bear in mind as well that for a generation that is the generation with all the wealth at the moment, they paid their mortgage through the years of double-digit interest rates. Okay, And, you know, that 90s recession was hard and it was harsh, and there was double digit interest rates and lots of people lost their homes. And they will know people who lost their homes and lost their livelihoods. So when you say to them, well, it's unearned wealth, they tend to come back to you with some fairly strong answers. But it is unearned wealth. It is, you know, not taxed. The money that they used to pay the mortgage was taxed, but the spectacular gains in equity of hundreds of thousands of pounds for a property that you've owned for 30 years, or nearly 40 years, isn't money that's taxed. But it's also money that you can't spend, you know, unless you downsize, unless you move out of your home. And downsizing isn't actually that financially beneficial for a lot of people, because they might live in a big house outside a town. They want to move to a smaller place closer to the town. All those places cost more money. You've got to sort of move out of the area. You might have to move to where you don't want to go to, or you do something like equity release is very expensive. You should only take it if you really need it. So there are all these difficulties. But let's look at the positives of a wealth tax as well, because anybody who supports a wealth tax will be ripping their hair out having listened to the start of this podcast. Capitalist pigs and their anti-wealth tax agenda. Right. Wealth taxes, firstly, are not very successful. Most countries that have a wealth tax have ended up getting rid of it because it doesn't work very well. It doesn't work very well because it's unpopular, as we've just spoken about, but also because you have to bring in so many exclusions, it starts not really being worth it. But they can work. They have been brought in before. One-off taxes, they've been used after major crises before. France, Germany, Japan, after the Second World War. Ireland had one after the financial crisis. Argentina has just passed a tax on its wealthiest. The argument for a wealth tax, one-off or for just for 5 years, and I'll leave you to make your own decision as to whether we bring in a wealth tax for 5 years and then it goes away after 5 years, is that it wouldn't discourage economic activity, right? So it doesn't stop people wanting to earn. The argument against high income taxes is it stops people wanting to earn. It'd be very difficult to avoid by moving money offshore or by emigrating, according to the Wealth Tax Commission. Is that true? Potentially, yes, if it's a limited time thing. Are people going to go to the trouble and the expense of moving abroad, moving assets abroad, which is hard and costs money, in order to avoid 5 years of tax? They'll go, okay, well, 5 years is going to cost me this, it's going to cost me that to do it. You have to be quite rich to do it. You could levy it, if you levy it on all assets, including main homes and pension pots, as well as business and financial wealth, then you cast the net very, very widely. You put in almost no exclusions and no loopholes. That means that you should scoop up a load of money, and that also it will be harder for the very wealthy to avoid it. There'll be less loopholes for them to take advantage of. So you have to try to make it as watertight as possible, and you make it paid by any UK resident. So that would include people like non-doms. So you go at it from the point of view of making it that there are as few exclusions as possible. You spread the net really widely. You promise to do it for a limited time only. You stick to your promise, and then you pull the money in. Can you do that? I mean, I don't know. Wealth Tax Commission say you can do. They did propose an alternative scenario. And the reason why we talked about millionaire couples is because it tends to be measured as household wealth. So for example, mine and my wife's would be measured together. So if between the two of us, we had a million, it'd get paid. So do you do it to individuals over £500,000? Maybe you do, I don't know. But they've suggested another idea, which is a threshold of £4 million. This would be considerably more palatable to most people. They'd see it as far enough away that it's not going to be a problem for them. Set per household. So if it's got two people in it, £2 million each, taxed at a rate of 1% per year on wealth above that threshold. It reckons that could raise £80 billion over 5 years after admin costs. It reckons the other idea, where you do couples, households over a million, would raise £260 billion over 5 years. And it says, as I said at the start of this, that this is a much better idea than raising the income tax for everyone. Because the problem with income tax is you're going to have to raise it for everyone. You can't just do it on high earners, because the Treasury has turned around and says this, well, look, the wealthy already do more than pay their way. You know, the top 1% of income taxpayers pay more than 29% of all income tax. The top 5% paid 50% of all income tax in 2019, 2020. And actually, arguably, I think we already do have three separate wealth taxes in this country. We have inheritance tax, we have capital gains tax, which is already subject to a review and could involve some form of tax rate that takes more money off people. And we have stamp duty, which is also arguably a wealth tax because it hits people buying more expensive homes. Do we need another one? I don't know. I mean, I guess listeners can probably hear that I'm not necessarily in favour of this idea. Will we get one? If you were to the Chancellor, would you do this? I mean, I'm not sure I would.
I don't know about this one particularly, but if you're talking about what's going to be popular, I imagine that it's going to be an easier sell to do something like this and clobber a couple of rich people than it is to increase income tax and VAT, which wasn't that manifesto promise from the Conservatives, on the masses.
Promises.
Is anyone going to believe that a government that says it's only going to be 5 years, because they can't even guarantee they're going to be in 5 years?
Of course they're not going to believe it's only going to be 5 years. Why would you believe that? Once they start getting the money in from it, of course it's going to be longer than 5 years. Look at stamp duty. Until Gordon Brown started meddling with it, it was a flat 1% on properties above £60,000, I think. And then he, as the property market boomed, he started raising the rates and cashing in. And now stamp duties are such a massive cash cow that we can't do anything about it. It causes major problems in the housing market. We've had a stamp duty holiday, which we're going to talk about in a minute, that's caused even more problems, rather than just cutting the tax. Look at inheritance tax as well. Inheritance tax catches many more people now than it was designed to. And it's projected to catch a lot more families. It's hugely unpopular. But once you start cashing in and taking all the money from it, you can't wean yourself off it. And I would see a wealth tax as being exactly the same. Once the government starts getting the money in from that, is it going to give it up? Is it going to go cold turkey on the wealth tax? Of course it isn't. And as for manifesto promises about, you know, income tax and VAT and stuff like that, to be honest, you know, we're in uncharted waters this year, aren't we? The government passed a law making it illegal to leave your house at one point. So I'm pretty sure they can tear up the manifesto promises.
Exactly. I have a weird one. Why not, Lee? The government asked people to voluntarily pay a lump sum of money. And Lee's laughing already. And if they haven't raised what they need to, and they do have to raise taxes, that's taken off. Whatever you voluntarily pay, taken off what you may have to pay if taxes are then brought in. But I wonder how generous the population or the wealthy would be in giving a one-off. That's, I suppose, the benefit to the wealth tax, potentially, if it's a one-off. But if it's something that's brought in, like you just mentioned, the inheritance tax, the stamp duty, Simon?
I can improve on that. Gamify it more.
Yeah.
You make a pledge to pay a lump sum of money to the government. And if they don't raise enough money and they do bring in a wealth tax, you get double that amount off your wealth tax.
Nice. I like that.
Yeah.
Lee, I wouldn't be targeted for a wealth tax, but I would do something like that.
Yeah, Georgia, I think you'd be in a minority if I'm being honest, because I think a lot of wealthy people would turn around and think to themselves, how much tax have I already paid over my lifetime? Do I want to be paying a bill for this coronavirus crisis?
This is a once-in-a-lifetime crisis that's going to impact generations.
If you're going to go down that route, I think people need something in return. There'd need to be some sort of IOU further down the line.
A brick with your name on it, like they do in football stadiums? maybe like use the most, there's a thing to do with, you know, you take money from your most engaged fans, right? So this is the whole fan club idea. And this is how a lot of, you know, music artists and things like that. Also some people doing, you know, creative stuff do it. I mean, you've got obviously Patreon where people volunteer to pay and you can volunteer to pay people. You've got other places where you have a sort of, you know, they don't charge you, but they say, please, would you give some money? But you make it a club thing, you know, you pay a certain amount, you get the t-shirt, you pay another certain amount, you get the hat as well, you pay another certain amount, you get to have dinner with the Chancellor. I'm listening to people going, isn't that just how Conservative Party contributions work? But the money doesn't go to the Conservative Party, the money goes to the government. And, you know, it becomes, you know, are you Britain's biggest fan? You build it up, gamify it completely. Yeah. Maybe we have some kind of, you know, Brit Aid concert, but you can only stream it live if you've chipped in at least 50 grand to the government. I think it would make us look really good in the eyes of the world. Pioneering and ideal for Brexit Britain as we go out into this world buccaneering, but not buccaneers who plunder, buccaneers who say, please, could you give us some money and we'll give you some merch.
Yeah, I like that. I've done my civic duty on the front of my t-shirt. What about you? Or something like that. Anyway, we were only going to touch on this subject, but knowing us, we never just touch on things, do we? But from the have to the have not, some 2.5 million mortgage payment holidays, let's go there, have been handed out since the government announced them back in March, this agreement with lenders to help homeowners during the coronavirus crisis. Now, for many, it's doubtless been a lifesaver, even with the fact they have to pay back the interest that still accrues during that break. But affordability repayments going up is not the only problem faced by homeowners. And before we get on to Steve and Irina from Cheshire, Lee, I'm going to ask you if that's all right. Just a quick word about mortgage payments, why they were brought in, who actually took them, because we've discussed this in the past. It wasn't just those people that needed them, because did you have to prove that you'd been affected badly by coronavirus? And when do they end? All that sort of logistical stuff.
Yeah, so no, not really, Georgie. And actually, mortgage payment holidays have been around for a long time. It hasn't just been coronavirus in which this kind of system has been in place. So you can take 3 months delayed holiday from your mortgage payments if you fall into, perhaps you lose your job, for example, and you might need to pause your mortgage payments for a few months to help you survive, you know, basically financially. So when coronavirus bit, one of the first things that was brought in was mortgage payment holidays, along with payment holidays for other type of loans and credit and things like that. And a lot of people decided to press the pause button on their mortgage payments for a few months. Basically, it's just added onto the term of your mortgage. So it's not like they've just disappeared. You've still got to pay them at some point along the road. But a lot of people who were furloughed or just lost their job or saw their income dry up took advantage of this and pressed pause on their mortgage payments. And it was going to be from March until the end of June. And then that was extended and then it's been extended again. So you can still actually apply for your mortgage holiday linked to coronavirus and the pandemic. But the amount of people that are doing it now is fallen right down. So it's good to see that the number of mortgage payment holidays is nowhere near what it was at the start of the crisis. I think it's down to something like 200,000 or something like that. So it's far lower than it was. A lot of people obviously had it until the end of June or perhaps the end of July and just gone back to paying their mortgage again. It was just a bit of breathing space.
Okay, so Steve and Irina, they took one of these. Lee, take up the story.
Yeah, so they got in touch with us. Basically, they were concerned because they took the mortgage payment holiday for 3 months. Irina was furloughed from her job and Steve had saw his income dry up. So they needed to press pause on their mortgage on their five-bedroom house, showing that, you know, it's a problem that was facing people that maybe have smaller homes and flats and things, but people that also have bigger homes. You know, people were hit by this in all different manner of ways, whether you were wealthy or you weren't wealthy. And I don't know their financial status, but to have a five-bedroom house in Cheshire, you know, it's one of those where you think, well, you think they're probably doing okay in life. So their mortgage payment is about £850 a month. They pressed pause on it for 3 months. And then after that 3 month period, realized that actually they needed to extend it. So they extended it in the summer. And this is where there's been a bit of mix up and confusion. Now, I'm going to put my hands up here and say I have sympathy both with the couple and with Nationwide Building Society, who we're talking about here. Because, look, there's been a lot of this going on. A lot of banks and building societies are always criticized and whatever. But they had a lot of mountain of these kind of things to go through, and a lot of people work at bank and building societies obviously would be doing it from home, and there's all kind of logistical problems with that, so that there could be all sorts of mix ups and things that go on here. And the worry we have I guess is that people will start having their credit scores hit for a variety of reasons when it comes to these payment holidays. And this is a case in point. So there's been a mix-up. For whatever reason, Nationwide didn't press pause on the payment in July. So it was due, and for whatever reason, there was no direct debit set up on this payment, right? So it was due. Nationwide said that they'd written to them twice, but they claimed to us that they never received the letters, you know, which Nationwide has done what it's meant to have done. So I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, Nationwide are the bad guys. They're telling us that their system showed that letters were sent out to the address. And then it transpired that the mortgage holiday kicked back in August, so they had another 3 months. But in that time, they just didn't realise that this payment was due. And it went on their credit report. Steve paid the amount that was then due when he realised. It went on his credit file, and Nationwide refused to take this mark off of his credit file. Now, the reason why that is such a big deal is because if you're looking to get credit again, especially if you're looking to get a big credit, which Steve and Irina were looking to do because they want to downsize. So they were having a mortgage approved for a smaller property. Obviously, change of circumstances perhaps has meant that they want to move into somewhere smaller. This was on their credit file. You know, you haven't paid your mortgage for that month. So Nationwide refused to take it off their credit report. And actually, they're under no obligation. You know, they're more under obligation to report that as a missed payment. Of course they are, because, you know, that's how the credit reporting system works. I'd like to think, though, that it's kind of, you could see it was a kind of bit of a communication mistake, you know, and that actually sometimes in these kind of cases, Nationwide just says, do you know what? You know, you've been a customer of us for a long time. You've never missed a payment before. This has been an unusual year. We don't think that you've, for whatever reason, can't pay it or whatnot, and maybe the right thing could have been done. Anyway, we got in touch with Nationwide. They've decided to take it off the credit note, and everyone's a winner. You know, they're hopefully getting their mortgage approved. They can downsize and get a tricky 2020 out of the way and move on for 2021.
Well, it's not everybody's a winner. I mean, in this case, everybody's a winner. But I mean, not everybody can get this as money to call up and get them to shift it. And given the fact that this is, like you said, it's a global pandemic, the reason that mortgage payment holidays were brought in is because people were potentially struggling. And also, it seems a very strange, maybe I'm wrong here, I understand that Nationwide say letters were sent out, etc. But why did they have that just 1 month and then bring it in August?
Well, exactly. That's where the confusion's come in. It would have been probably some sort of cut-off deadline, I'd imagine. Perhaps they didn't get in touch in time to make it roll on for that following month, and then there's been this 1 month gap. But you would have thought from seeing that record that you know having that 1 month back on and then 3 months off was a bit unusual. But again, I was just saying, Georgie, I'm going to stick up for banks and building sites again here, which is not something I do very regularly. But you know they've had a lot of this communication and phone. You know it's been a really stressful time for both customers and for banking staff. You know there's been a lot extra work. I would argue, and these kind of mistakes, I'm sure it won't be the first. I'm sure it won't be the last. And if something like this has happened to you, get in touch with us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. And that means mortgage payments, credit card holidays, loan payments, car finance payments. If there's some sort of unusual thing that's happened to you and you don't think it's right and your credit report has been affected in some way, please do get in touch.
So the tip, I guess, to sort of round this off is always double check, double, triple check. You know, go online to your payments. Make sure that if you are coming to the end of a mortgage payment holiday, even if you think you're getting another one or whatever, always double check.
Definitely. And actually, just I think sometimes people have this process of, especially if you find yourself falling into financial hard times, is just burying your head in the sand and thinking, oh, well, it'll all be all right. I've sorted out that mortgage payment holiday. I literally check my mortgage account every week, you know, for no other reason than I just like to keep an eye on it because it's basically the biggest amount of debt that I owe. And it's a huge amount of debt. And I like to just kind of refresh myself and remind myself and just make sure everything's okay with it. That's probably over the top. But I would say it's a kind of, depending on your mortgage, the type of thing you should definitely be keeping an eye on once a month and making sure everything's okay. In my mind, that's my opinion.
Seems very sensible. All right, from one housing-related holiday to another. Simon, you mentioned it a little bit earlier. We're going to talk about stamp duty. Again, another measure brought in by the government in response to coronavirus. So those buying homes under £500,000 don't have to pay any stamp duty until the 31st of March 2021. Brilliant, except for one thing. House prices have gone up, well, so much that they're likely to have wiped out any savings you've made from the holiday. Simon, that's not brilliant, is it?
Not brilliant. No, I like that, Georgie. House price reports should be taken with a pinch of salt. I am aware that you may possibly be the last person who needs to be told that, considering your view on house price reports. However, the major indices that have been running for a long time are good for spotting a trend. They might not be entirely accurate. They might all have a different number for the average house. What is really even the average house anyway? But there is some serious methodology that goes into it from very, very clever people, smarter people than any of us here, certainly with the numbers. And you can spot a trend. And Halifax's long-running house price report has identified a trend. The trend is that basically the stamp duty holiday appears to now officially be a false economy. The average house price in November stood at £253,243. That is a seriously chunky £15,409 more than the average price for the report of June. On July the 8th, the Chancellor announced a stamp duty holiday on the first £500,000 of any property purchase price. So you go above 500 grand, the most you'll save is 15. Go below 500 grand, you'll save less than 15. Now you can see the relationship there between the maximum saving from the stamp duty holiday and how much the average house price has gone up. And the average house price isn't even anywhere near what you would save 15 grand on. The average house price is just over £250,000. And the stamp duty saving that you could make on that average house price is 2,650. So basically, if you buy the average home now versus before the stamp duty holiday, you will pay £15,000 more for it in order to save £2,650 in tax. False economy. Done deal. Job done. Everyone's a mug. You've all lost out. You've been had. Is that true? No, not really, is it? Because let's face it, there's a number of different scenarios going on here. The property market had already started to pick up. In fact, actually, house prices hit their year low in June on that Halifax index. But the property market had already started to pick up in June. It was doing considerably better in in-demand areas, particularly those out of town, you know, towns near the countryside, the sort of rush to the country thing that was going on. Much better than estate agents expected. That was why there was a surprise that Rishi Sunak did announce the stamp duty holiday in July, because it was a sort of, it's not needed now. And there was actually the suggestion at the time that there was a leak and he got bumped into it because he intended to wait and maybe do it in November. Someone leaked it. And then once it was leaked, he had to do it, because if you're being told that there's going to be a big tax cut in November, you are not going to buy a house until November. Because you're going to go, right, oh, we can save some money here. The opposite happened this time around. It's a temporary holiday. It runs out on the 31st of March. Lots of people, particularly in the expensive areas of England, where an average family home can cost you more than £500,000, went, I hate stamp duty. Stamp duty is one of the things that really puts me off moving. I could save quite a bit of money here. I'm going to try and move. As a lesson in inflation, the stamp duty holiday is an absolute banger. Because basically what happened is a load of people decided to buy, the sellers realized that they could try to put their prices up, and prices went up. So it's one on that sense. It's also one on the sense that lots more people are moving. Transactions are high, and mortgage brokers and banks and conveyancers are overrun with people trying to move home. And then those people spend money. They spend it, you know, getting new kitchens, getting new bathrooms, buying new sofas, buying curtains, paying electricians, paying plumbers, doing all those other things. So it does stimulate the economy. Economically, it's foolish, though, because it drives up house prices, and high house prices are one of the main problems that this country has, and actually inhibit economic activity, because people have to divert money that they could put to more economically useful means into paying oversized mortgages. But back to the, did people definitely lose out? Well, theoretically, if you make an offer on a property now and have it accepted in the hope that you're going to get it through before the end of the stamp duty holiday, compared to if you'd have made that offer on the property in June, yeah, you're definitely going to lose out. But all those people who've bought aren't necessarily in that position. Some of them will have agreed deals on properties that were on sale before the stamp duty cut. Maybe they were on sale before the lockdown property freeze, and they've been on the shelf for some time. So maybe they managed to negotiate well on the price. They then put their house on the market and got a reasonable price for it. Maybe the extra bit of activity meant that they got a decent price for theirs, but they managed to negotiate really well on the place they were buying. It wasn't an absolute house that everybody wanted, you know, and went to sort of asking price or above, you know. So they might have won out as well. Maybe actually even some of those people who perhaps, if you did look at the numbers, have just indulged in a false economy, maybe they don't really actually care, because it's not just all about the numbers, is it? It's about home. And maybe what it meant was those people could move home. They got their home sold and they managed to buy the place that they wanted to move to. And ultimately, they feel like they've saved a little bit of money on tax. They'll actually probably end up paying more money for the house on a mortgage over the years, and it'll cost them more. But, you know, it swings and roundabouts. And they're in a home that they really like now. Maybe they're in there now already for Christmas. Cold hard numbers says false economy. Cold hard numbers say exercise in inflation lesson. Personally, I say deal with the problem, make the stamp duty cut permanent, remove the time limited element, removes the inflationary pressure, and let's move on and make it cheaper and easier for people to move home. And then hopefully more people will do it, and that will be an economic benefit for the long term.
Lee, you're nodding along throughout that.
Well, Simon's just such a man of wise words and wisdom. I was just nodding along there because I think there has been some real winners in the property market with the stamp duty cut. And one of them is just some friends, basically, that had an offer accepted on a house that they took a massive cut off anyway. So they haggled the price down close to £500,000. They'd already sold their home. And then they were going down the line with the process. And then the stamp duty cut came in and it's like, well, you know, as he put it, it's like another £15,000 off the house. You know, but they had that all in line before, you know, the stamp duty cut wasn't in play. That wasn't what they, you know, trying to take advantage of. And now, as someone says, it's kind of like that false economy of since then, people are now wanting to kind of rush through these stamp house purchases for the stamp duty cut, but are probably paying more money for the homes than they would have done. So I just think it's a really interesting sort of impact that's had. And if it does just end at the end of March, what happens from there? What happens to property prices? I've seen all sorts of kind of interesting reports about price drops next year. But of course, if there is a sort of 5% price drop or 10%, to be honest, there's been that kind of price rise since the summer. So although it will look bad on paper, it's just kind of like wiping out these stamp duty cut gains. It's an incredibly interesting area. And as Simon always says about stamp duty and how it affects how people buy, you do just wonder what is the point of it other than making some money for the treasury. But when people buy a house, you know, the economic activity around that, you know, they might strip out the kitchen and have a new one put in. You know, they might do all these kind of home improvements that cost money, that go to businesses, that create jobs. So it's all of that balance of how it all works. And I'd find the topic fascinating, Georgie. Fascinating. Well, and when Simon goes in full flow, that's why I'm nodding along, because I'm like, you know, this is good stuff.
I think it's worth noting that there are another bunch of people who will feel that they've missed out here. And those were people who decided that they wanted to move to take advantage of it and didn't get an offer on their home, that they put their house on the market in a market that supposedly is really buoyant, and they didn't get the offer that they wanted. And maybe they even priced sensibly in the first place, because estate agents were definitely trying to get people to do that. To price sensibly rather than optimistically, to get people through the door and then make some offers. And sometimes it just doesn't work out for you. And it's really frustrating trying to sell your home and not getting offers. You know, there is an argument that, well, you should just cut the price. But we moved, you know, recently, and it took us a long time to sell our flat in London. The offer we accepted on our flat was, you know, all the way back last September, not the September just gone, but the September before. But it was all through that Brexit, you know, year, the worries about no deal, the Theresa May to Boris Johnson thing and everything like that. And the market was absolutely awful in London. So it was theoretically a bad time to sell, but then it makes it a good time to buy. All we needed was a decent offer. We had priced our flat relatively sensibly. We didn't want to just slash the price, which, I mean, obviously if you slash the price low enough, you will get a sale. But the agents were saying to us, it's not necessarily price that's an issue at the moment. It's people won't commit. They think they're really worried about the future. Little did people know, when they were worried about stuff in 2019, quite what 2020 would throw up. And then amazingly, 2020 throws that up and the property market goes bananas. So sometimes it's just tough and it doesn't work out for you. But I do feel sorry for people who didn't get their home sold. And then at the same time as they were getting under the asking price offers, they're seeing places that they want going for nearly asking price, or now they're seeing places that come onto the market going for an asking price, going on an asking price that's slightly higher than the one before and slightly higher than the one before. They feel like they missed out on places. Should we have taken the lower offer? Emotionally, it's very draining and quite stressful sometimes, but they will probably feel that they've lost out now because they've gone, right, well, it's too late now. That's it. We've heard all of this talk about stamp duty window of opportunity shutting because you won't get a sale through by the 31st of March, and taking the property off the market and gone, it's not going to happen for us. But do you know what? If it does end on the 31st of March and then the heat comes out of the market, and it will come out of the market before the 31st of March, if it ends on the 31st of March, then actually maybe they'll be in a better position to come back onto the market next Easter, hopefully get an offer on their place and not be trying to buy at a time when, you know, stuff is going asking and over asking and the property market is overheated. So if you're one of those people, I would say, don't worry, you know, it'll happen for you. just be patient and just try again come, you know, after the stamp duty deadline, because you might not get the tax cut, but you'll probably end up paying less for a property than if you get an offer accepted now, going back to the Halifax figures that we were talking about at the start of this conversation.
More wise words there, Ailey, from Simon. Right, let's talk about pensions, because last week we spoke about the company pension fund of Arcadia. That's the owner of Topshop and Burton, went into administration, of course, last week. And we saw it with BHS when that went under, and the concern of a large underfunded pension scheme for many workers. We spoke about the pension lifeboat and all that. What is less talked about, perhaps, is that even in pretty sturdy companies, ones that you really wouldn't expect that any problems will come to them, I mean, don't say they're too big to fail, but you know what I mean. A large pension scheme can be a red flag for investors to take note of, because companies that have large numbers of workers enrolled in defined benefit schemes are often on the hook to pay out billions to retirees over time. So should you look a little closer than at company schemes if you are an investor? Simon, companies like who? What is the issue we're talking about here?
Well, the issue is that if you're a company that's got a sizable defined benefit pension scheme, historic mainly, it's highly unlikely you're accepting new entrants. You've made a promise, and it's quite a cast iron promise. It's very difficult to unshackle yourself from this promise without actually going bust. And that is right, that it should be like that, to pay people a relatively substantial amount of money for many, many years to come. And the problem is that the cost of paying people that money has escalated, because it's directly linked to gilt yields. Large pension funds tend to invest very, very cautiously, very safe government bonds, and interest rates on those have absolutely collapsed. They've been on the downward trend for many years. And then since the financial crisis, and then now since coronavirus crisis, all this money printing, quantitative easing, which involves central banks buying up the gilts and other bonds, has absolutely hammered the yields on them. So the cost of delivering that income to the people who once worked for you, your ex-employees who are now pensioners, has risen substantially. And the problem is, the more the cost of that has risen, the more cautious pension trustees have got in many cases in terms of investment. So they've missed out on the large stock market gains, because there are rules and there are regulations, and there is also just concern about, they don't want to be the person carrying the can for the fact that they, you know, shifted the pension scheme to a more risky style of investing, and then the market tanked. And it can be a real drain on resources, because as a company, you have to keep paying money into it in order to keep trying to, you know, see off some of that shortfall to top it up. Famously, BT is... BT is often referred to as a very large pension fund with a smaller company attached to it, owing to the size of its liabilities. So some of these companies are some big names that people would recognise. Stagecoach Group, it's got a market cap of 208 million, and its pension deficit as a percentage of its market cap is 198.6%. So nearly double that. Now, Stagecoach has obviously been really suffering, because road and rail ain't been a great business to be in this year. BT, market cap, £10 billion. Pension deficit as a percentage of market cap, 78%. First Group, again, pension deficit as percentage of market cap, 64%. So as you can see, these are companies that have big pension deficits. And that's not the pension scheme, that's the pension deficit as a percentage of the size of the company. Capita, TUI, Dixon's Carphone Warehouse, Rolls-Royce, BAE, and then you've got Greencore, Mitchells and Butlers, Petrofac, Morgan Advanced Materials, RHI, Magnesita, who I must admit I've not heard of. This analysis has been run by Simon McGarry of Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, and he said that it's the kind of thing that people should watch out for when they are investing, and bear in mind and say, well, that company looks cheap. It might look cheap on price to earnings multiples and things like that, but have you taken the whacking great pension fund and deficit into account? Now, the flip side of that is, if a company is being heavily marked down because of its pension deficit, if things turn around, gilt yields suddenly start to rise, inflation picks up, interest rates go up, all that kind of stuff, you can find that all of a sudden that company's share price gets a little bit of a rocket underneath it, because that pension deficit doesn't look anywhere near so bad as it once did.
Is it our old friend diversification, Simon? I mean, we're not saying here, if you're looking at your portfolio, run to the hills screaming if you see one of those companies on there.
No, I mean, obviously diversification, if you're investing in individual companies, you need at least 15 to 20 different companies that do different things in order to have a properly diversified portfolio. Ideally, you would be investing around the world, although many people investing in individual shares in this country may probably only be investing in UK companies, but maybe target some UK companies that earn most of their money from overseas rather than just lots that, you know, you don't want a portfolio of only of ones that earn their money in the UK. But likewise, you know, don't have a portfolio only of companies with massive pension deficits.
Exactly.
So look out for that one as well.
All right, then, finally, just a quick one. We had a ports update a couple of weeks ago, but it seems we're due for another one. This is the This Is Money exclusive story about chaos at the ports. Lee, what's the latest?
This is becoming the port podcast, isn't it, Georgie? Maybe we should go into to shipping podcasts. George Nixon, our reporter, chased this all up in September. He did a stellar job tracking all this down, where we were receiving reports of companies, especially import-export companies, that were seeing chaos at Felixstowe Port, where basically there'd been a backlog of containers that had piled up due to a combination of factors, mainly coronavirus-linked, where they'd just been a load of containers show up. A lot of drivers were furloughed, for example. It takes longer to turn around containers because of having to take social distancing measures, all of that kind of thing. And we told, George even asked the Department for Transport at the time, were they aware of it? Were they keeping an eye on it? And because it's a commercial port, they kind of said they were aware of it, but it's a commercial port. Let's fast forward to today. And 3 months later, this has blown up like we thought it would. George was just really quite ahead of the curve on this one, and This Is Money. This has become a national story. Basically, there's been a perfect storm, as we predicted, of coronavirus, Brexit, looming Brexit. Remember that? That seemed to happen in a few weeks. Christmas rush, so festive rush, you know, of companies getting importing goods ready for what would usually be a huge rush at Christmas for consumers to buy things. And that still is the case, just because it's a bit different, because maybe more people are buying online. But these goods still have to come in. Now this contagion of kind of chaos at the port seems to have spread to Southampton and to the London Gateway. So they're struggling too, for all of the reasons that I mentioned before. And what's happening from a real business level and from a small business level is that small businesses are getting hit quite hard by this. So they've already had a tough year. You know, they might have had to furlough staff. They might have seen orders or whatever, revenue down. And now they're having to deal with containers that perhaps were already booked in. And the price of these containers to be shipped in is growing substantially. Basically, we've got one report of a company that was saying not that long ago to get a 40-foot container in would cost £1,500. That's now costing £7,500. And if you start extrapolating that over how many containers you get, I would suspect that there's some businesses now that are facing up to pressure saying, well, the business is either going to sink, this isn't viable anymore, or we might have to make staff cuts. It's chaos, Georgie. This chaos, I'm going to predict, is going to continue. Can't lay it all down to Brexit, because I think coronavirus has caused this big, it is a perfect storm. It really is a perfect storm of Brexit, coronavirus, and Christmas. But once Christmas ends, and then we just have the two elements, I still think that this is going to continue for some time. And it's a worry. And if you're a business affected, you should definitely get in touch with us, because we're hearing all sorts of reports. Even Honda, you know, a company as big as Honda in Swindon has had to halt production because it can't get the parts that it needs to make the cars because of all the backlog of what they need coming in from this port chaos. It's not good, Georgie. It does not look good.
Have we had any reassurances from the government or the ports?
Michael Gove was on talking about this, I think, on BBC, and he was saying that they were kind of aware of it, and I'm guessing, you know, the thing is, they've been aware of this obviously for a long time. We've all been aware of this for a long time, Brexit looming and what it might do to the ports, and what, you know, we've Dover, for example, you know, this whole thing about a lorry park and all that kind of stuff. The thing is about Dover, that is, you know, obviously quite European focused. It focuses on mainly items that are coming in from Europe. Felixstowe is a more of an international port, as in it gets in items from the Far East, for example. It's where a lot of our international goods come through. So the focus has been in the last few years all on Dover. Dover. Everything has been on Dover. I feel like other ports haven't really been thought about very much. And we don't just rely on Dover. That is not the be-all, end-all port of Britain. Felixstowe deals with way more cargo than Dover. It's just because a lot of people have used Dover for the Channel Tunnel, so they know where it is, and it's that worry of getting stuck in traffic trying to get across the border and all that kind of stuff. But I think that, personally, I think the government has dropped the ball a little bit on this. And, you know, if we're going to be a country that's looking to trade, import, export with you know, a raft of different countries, I think we're going to have to be looking at a new port, for example. Personally, I think there needs to be some sort of big infrastructure investment into all of this, because this is chaos, Georgie. This is hitting businesses hard. If we're talking about that kind of price for containers going forward for the rest of next year, we're going to see, we've seen all the retail casualties, you know, Arcadia, Debenhams. We could see a whole, you know, a whole level of other companies going bust from just simply soaring costs from ports. And the government has got to get a grip of this, whether it's commercially run ports or whether it's ports that's run by the Department for Transport or whatever it is. It all needs a massive look at. I'm sure this has been done. But it's just at the moment, I think coronavirus has just really exacerbated all of this. You know, to think about how you can turn a container around is obviously a very heavy thing, depending on what's inside it, unloading it and all that kind of thing, while socially distancing and putting it onto lorries and all of that kind of stuff, and having a shortage of lorry drivers, all kind of things that ports just wouldn't have foreseen at the start of the year. This is a case now of everything just coming together at a bad time.
I mean, one of the things as well that's causing this problem is the whole stockpiling issue, as Lee said. Could that have been foreseen at the start of the year? I don't know. I mean, did we think that Brexit was going to go to the wire, or it was going to all be sorted?
Simon, we've been talking about stockpiling for ages, of course.
I know, but the firms are stockpiling huge amounts of stuff. They are. So, I mean... It's, you know, they did it. I mean, they did it kind of same time last year. So that's definitely exacerbating it, combined with all the, you know, the social distancing and everything, as Lee said. Did lead to the wonderful line from Michael Gove of, well, there's all things people say, Brexit ate my homework. The question that Brexit stockpiling was causing it is, Brexit ate my homework. The classic excuse. But would have been nice if it had been sorted by now, is all I'll say. And that we didn't need to be doing the stockpiling. And if we weren't going to sort it, maybe we'd have kind of decided not to do this whilst battling the second wave of coronavirus.
Yeah, I think your point was, this year has seen many things crop up that we could not foresee and we could not do anything about, that potentially this issue that you're talking about may not have had to have been so bad. 100%
avoidable. Right, offered the opportunity to extend the transition deadline in the middle of this year, when coronavirus and lockdown was already a thing, and decided to turn that opportunity down, therefore ended up with the scenario occurring at the exact same time as people said there was going to be a second wave of coronavirus, and we still have massive restrictions in place.
This subject has the legs of a whole nother podcast, Simon.
Yeah, 100% avoidable. Could have been pushed back. Could quite easily have been pushed back.
All right, Simon. As I said, this has the legs of a whole nother podcast. But alas, we don't have time. We are out of time this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. Join in the debate in reader comments.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.